You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Writer Francisco Cantú, in his debut book, The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border, offers a unique voice in the canon of border literature. This memoir is nuanced and deeply personal. It's rooted in the land that Francisco, or Paco as he's known amongst friends, calls home and has been part of his lineage, from his Mexican grandfather who was brought north across a border, to his mother who worked in the Park Service her entire career, to Cantú's own academic studies and his deep yearning to know more. His writing, at times sparse, is both poetic and vast in its ability to convey the deep sentiment of his struggle and the ensuing trauma in his role as a Border Patrol agent from 2008 to 2012. His narrative stretches back to the 1800s to give context for the foundation of a frequently shifting and haphazardly defined international boundary between Mexico and the United States. And it also delves into how the violence at the border has been reduced to dehumanizing metaphors in journalism, how death on the border is represented in mass numbers, lumped together in a way that erases the emotional capacity to understand the gravity of each and every single death that occurs on the line. His own story is complex, and his choices are often at odds with those of his own family. This work explores that journey. Francisco Cantú was a Fulbright Fellow and the recipient of a 2017 Whiting Award. His essays and translations have been featured on This American Life, Harper's, Guernica, and others. Francisco will be in conversation with journalist Roxandra Guidi, a Venezuelan native and LA resident, an independent journalist with more than 15 years of experience working in public radio, magazines, and multimedia. Roxandra has reported throughout the Americas, as well as the U.S.-Mexico border region, and worked as a reporter, editor, and producer for NPR's Latino USA, BBC Daily News, and the Fronteras Desk in San Diego, Tijuana, and KPCC's Immigration and Emerging Communities Beat in Los Angeles. Tonight's program follows a rich offering of recent programs exploring migrant stories and the indigenous viewpoint that accompanied the visual art exhibition in the library's rotunda for the Visualizing Language Oaxaca in LA exhibition. These stories were told by varied voices, artists, linguists, community activists, undocumented workers. The commonality between these conversations is that gathering together here in your library, in community, we practiced respectful listening, compassion, and open ourselves to complex and challenging topics that can't be understood through a singular lens, nor reduced to one singular conversation. But at best, open up the opportunity for dialogue, to see an issue more broadly than before, to perhaps also consider a different perspective and carry it into the world for further reflection. As our national leadership fails to communicate with respect and dignity, nor allows opportunity for dialogue, we as a community can model these values together and strengthen our capacity to lead by example.
So this, the line becomes the river, and it starts out being really straight, and then it gets really curvy and erratic, and it seems like it's never going to end. Can you talk about growing up with this line, or near this line?
I'm really glad that we watched that film, because the film is basically the title of the book. Mm-hmm. I didn't steal the title from that film, but I was thinking a lot about, when I was trying to come up with a title for this book, I was thinking a lot about maps, really, about the way that the border is mapped onto the landscape and sort of what borders we accept as natural, a mountain range or a river, and what borders feel imposed. Mm-hmm. And I think that even in watching that film, you feel the rigidity of the border, you know, that is cut across California, Arizona, mm-hmm. New Mexico, and then there's this whole other feeling to watching it snake around into the idea that is, flowing,
yeah,
and changing, and you know, I didn't grow up right on the border. I grew up in the Southwest. I think, you know, for me, the border was close enough to not be completely abstract, but mm-hmm. far away enough to be, strange and compelling.
To want to dream of becoming a cowboy sometime, right, as you mentioned.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was I was sort of instilled with that, by my mother, who was a park ranger, and my father, who, you know, was like literally riding horses around and mm-hmm. wearing cowboy hats. I grew up in national parks during, you know, like the first memories that I have are from these like wide open desert mm-hmm. spaces. I think that does something amazing to a mind mm-hmm. when it, you know, really the first things that it can grasp onto are landscapes.
Yeah. Yeah. And your mom worked at the National Park Service.
Yeah, you know,
so
the
it must have influenced.
The book opens in the Guadalupe Mountains National Park, which mm-hmm. is maybe an hour and a half from El Paso in West Texas, mm-hmm. Near the border with New Mexico. And so that's really where I guess came of age and started to have memories. It's very arid, very wide open, rugged landscape.
Mm-hmm. If I'm doing the math correctly, you must have been just at a college, right? 22, 23, when you decided to join the Border Patrol. You were just a child.
Yeah, it's true. I'm still just a child. I was 22 years old when I made the decision. I was a senior in college, mm-hmm. Very naive and I think also like idealistic, and mm-hmm. also I think at that age, you know, you have this very fully formed sense of who you are, right? You've just been on your own, and you feel like you know mm-hmm. who you are, and that you're not necessarily invincible, but that like your moral code and your sense of ethics
and ideology
and your ideology mm-hmm. is sort of infallible. And so, you know, I signed up when I was 22, and I had when I was at the academy, I had just turned 23.
So what were you hoping to find? Because if I understand correctly, you didn't have this book in mind, right? Were you thinking of it as research, or wanting to explore the history on the mm-hmm. ground in the field? What really motivated you?
You know, there were a few things. I think first and foremost, I looked at joining the Border Patrol as an extension of my education. I didn't look at it as a career move. I didn't, you know, it was something that I thought I would do for, you know, 4 to 6 years. And also, you know, I had all of these questions. I was in a 4-year program for international relations, and you know, within that program, I focused my studies on immigration and border issues, and double majored in Spanish, and lived abroad in Mexico. And so I had, and I also, I think importantly, worked at this nonprofit, like an immigration policy think tank in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so I had all of these policy questions. I mean, a lot of the same questions that we are asking right now and that we're grappling with right now. And I thought that, but I also felt, because I had grown up, you know, so close to the landscape of the Southwest, like the book learning that I had done, and of course the policies, felt so disconnected from the realities of the landscape that I knew, or that I didn't know, but that I, you know, had a sense of. And so I think that was also a big part of the decision, was wanting to connect those dots. You know, I felt that I would see something during those years in the Border Patrol that would like unlock these questions for me. I would have like the secret key to solve America's immigration policy or something like that. And I imagined that I would leave the Border Patrol and be able to become a policymaker or an immigration lawyer with all the secret answers.
And yet you came out with some answers, or at least you formulated a lot of questions in those 4 years you were there.
I came out with better questions.
Yeah, better formulated questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I was hoping you could read a little bit from the beginning of the book, because one of the things that struck me about your book pretty early on is that you were confronted with doubts and questions and nightmares about your place in Border Patrol and what your role was and what you were witnessing. And those really stuck with me as a reader, the dreams, the nightmares, the visions of wolves. And so I don't know if you want to read. I think it was page 14 or 13.
So I read, this is sort of at the very beginning. In the dream, I am hunched over in the darkness. The floor of the cave is covered with black shapes, arms and legs severed from the bodies that once carried them. I touch them and hold them in my hands, feeling dirt and blood and cold skin. I sort through the parts for a head, for the remnants of a face, for something to identify the people who were deposited here. I leave the cave empty-handed, emerging into a landscape devoid of color, the air still and raw. Outside, a voice tells me I must visit a wolf in a nearby cave. When I arrive there, little light is left in the sky. I walk through a stone passageway until I must squint to see through the darkness. At the back of the cave, I can make out the rough shape of an animal circling in the shadows. Soon I discern the outline of a wolf walking slowly toward me, one paw placed silently before the next. As the animal approaches, my body swells with terror. I look over my shoulder and see the figure of my mother, gesturing for me to hold out my hand, to offer it to the wolf. I look forward and hold out my arm, breathing deeply as I open my palm. The wolf slowly comes near, stretching its neck to sniff my hand with its massive muzzle. The animal seems truly fearsome, but also wise. As it steps back to regard me, I sense that something is being communicated. The wolf approaches me again, this time standing slowly on its back legs and reaching for me, placing its paws on my chest. I am startled by the size of its paws, by how heavy they feel against my chest. The wolf leans into me and brings its face close to mine, as if to tell me a secret. I close my eyes and feel its hot breath against my cheeks, its wet tongue on my face, licking the insides of my mouth. Then, suddenly, I awake.
So there's the wolf, which is clearly a terrifying visual, but there's also your mom, right? And that was another thing I was hoping you could talk to us about. Your mom was the one critical voice throughout, right? And yet, whom you had a closest relationship to, at least that we get to hear about, read about in the book. And I'm curious how much of your relationship with your mother during these 4 years in the Border Patrol kind of like engendered this book, or how that relationship evolved over the course of your time at the Border Patrol?
I actually think there's a really close relationship between like the figure of my mother and the role of those dreams, because I think that those two things were sort of, after I was sort of in the thick of it, those two things were the only tether that I had, I think, to who my sense of who I was outside of this job, or who I was when I joined. And my mother was really the only person holding me accountable for the decision and like interrogating the decision, you know, even long after I had stepped into the job. And, you know, of course, at the time, it feels like your mom is nagging and like, leave me alone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she was reminding me of the reasons that I gave her when I joined and, you know, reminding me of the idea of myself that I had when I joined the Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the dreams were this subconscious manifestation of I think, horror and doubt at what I was a part of. And of course, I pushed those dreams away for so long. And, you know, when I think about them now, they're really these alarm bells. Mm-hmm. That dream, the dream of the wolf, was Jung talks about a big dream. There's like a few dreams in our life that really have the power
recurring dreams.
Yeah, to recur or to shake us. Mm-hmm. You know, they're almost, it's a dream that, you know, wants to grab onto us and shake us out of some disconnect between our waking life and our unconscious life. And so for me, that dream, you know, even when I sat up from that dream, it's one of the few times I've ever, you know, sat up in the night and reached for a notebook, something to write on. And I remember I was in Lordsburg, New Mexico, sharing a hotel room with a coworker, and I like went into the bathroom and turned on the light so that I could write that down. Yeah.
So I'm curious about where in the process of you being a Border Patrol agent did the idea for a book come about, or were you just journaling and thinking this is your way to work yourself, you know, work you through know, this process?
I answer that question differently depending on the day. Right. I think, you know, usually, I mean, honestly, it's interesting that you asked me to read from that section, from that dream, because for me, I think that dream was it shook me and rattled me so much, and it was the thing that set me on the path toward investigation. Like, I started reading, you know, it started with, I don't know, internet dream forums or symbol websites where you're like, what does it mean when you dream of a wolf?
Yeah.
But, you know, I became so interested in like unlocking that dream, that sort of set me on the path. I was like, oh, I have to be writing this down. I have to be gathering these, you know, the same way that you write a research paper, like, oh, this quote here. I started reading books about the wolf in the Southwest. The Mexican gray wolf was driven basically to the point of extinction, and then slowly has been repopulating the landscape. And so I was doing a lot of research about that. But you know, the other piece, the other answer that I give is that I had these journal entries, and you know, I didn't keep a journal every day. But it was these encounters that I would have with people who were crossing the desert. And, you know, at the end of the day, it becomes so normal. You know, that happens maybe not every day, but a couple times a week. And there would be certain encounters that I was like, you know, if I don't write this down, it's going to slip away, and I won't remember this person or this conversation. And so I think I was writing them down, just, you know, quick observational, to remember, to guard against forgetting. And there's so many of those encounters that did slip away that I just never had the time to write them down.
I mean, as someone who's covered immigration and done reporting on the border, I'm always curious about, first of all, I've always wanted to get inside the mind of a Border Patrol agent. I'm not sure you can speak for all Border Patrol agents, but no, I've always been curious about the process of the that way in which you must become desensitized to what's happening around you, and that almost dehumanization process that needs to happen for you in order to keep arresting these people, you know, keep sending them back across the border, never mind their stories, never mind their particular situation. And how what it is that you do is feeding a certain rhetoric, right? As we see that especially right now in this last year of Trump. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the feelings that went on and that pushback. It must have been very difficult to feel the way that I know you feel in reading your book, mm-hmm. and yet being part of this agency, which has a very clear mandate, right?
I think it's really the central question of the book is how we can be made to normalize violence in our lives as individuals, and also more broadly, you know, as a society, or as a group, and also the great power and sway that an institution has over the people that step into it. I think looking back on it, you know, when I left the Border Patrol, I think you slowly come back to who you are, to this idea of you just as a human. Mm-hmm. And I think that the closer I came back to my sense of who I was, the more alarming what I had been a part of. You know, it was almost like becoming naked or something. Mm-hmm. And I think the book really began as a way of investigating that. What's so alarming looking back on it is that, you know, the idea that you specifically join this institution. I think this happens to so many young people. Mm-hmm. You step into an institution thinking that you can be a force for good within the agency, within the institution, or that, you know, that you can somehow change it from within, or, you know, all these idealistic thoughts that we have as a young person. But what jars me is how quickly that gets put away. And of course, you know, the Border Patrol, like most military or law enforcement jobs, is designed that way. I mean, from the minute you step into a training academy, mm-hmm. it is designed to break down the particulars of who you are and to rebuild you in the image of a law enforcement agent who is, you know, ready to step out into the field and, you know, just, you know, be flooded with these realities and, you know, keep getting up the next day and coming back to work and accepting them as normal. But, you know, these are not normal things. And so the job forces you to set aside, you know, compassion and humanity. I think it's possible to do the job to some extent with a sense of compassion, but only sort of like next to it, you know? Mm-hmm. You can be next to it, but you can't inhabit it.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet I think that process that you're talking about is what's most fascinating to me is that it happens also for many Border Patrol agents who come from many of these mm-hmm. immigrant, you know, families or are Mexican American themselves, growing up across the border, aware of that reality. It's just interesting to me that we hadn't seen much of a critique of that phenomenon, but also that it's a powerful force, right?
I think what's so strange about that is, of course, it's almost an archetype, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Latino agent who, you know, becomes, you know, enters immigration enforcement. And I think what was incredible to me is how simple that decision is for so many people.
Of accepting a job or getting a job.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's so many rural communities in the borderlands where, you know, if you're growing up in those communities and you look at, you know, who owns a house, who's able to provide for their family, who has a nice car, you know, they're either in law enforcement or working for the cartel, or they leave. And so I think it's an incredibly simple decision for so many people. And, you know, I was in the Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the country. It's there's something now, I think there's, you know, there's, it's falling, but I think there's between 15,000 to 18,000 agents. That's more than the FBI or the DEA. And so you have people from all walks of life. You certainly have a lot of prior military and law enforcement people, but you also have, you know, at the academy, there's like an 18-year-old kid whose only job was, you know, just graduated from high school and had worked at Dairy Queen and from Douglas, Arizona. And, you know, you think about people stepping in to that institution at that age, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I was 23. I was probably in the middle age range-wise. And so you're really forming, you know, consciousness is, people's consciousness is being shaped by that job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like everything else, you're presented with these simple equations in order to get through the day, right? Like,
yeah,
this is your job. These people are breaking the law. It's simple. You know, that's what you're being told.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's some days when you play the good cop and others when you're... Mm-hmm. You're the bad cop, right? And there's a section in your book in which you talk about our use of language and how we come to refer to immigrants that speaks to this very eloquently. I think it was in page 102, 109. I was wondering if you could read from that.
You know, became so obviously, you know, starting out writing this book, I was interrogating my personal experience of like how I had been, you know, conditioned to participate in and perpetuate violence and policy that, you know, even before joining I knew was just inherently flawed and violent and wrongheaded. And but of course as I began thinking about this more broadly, I became interested in, you know, how as societies and how as an entire culture we normalize violence. And I think that in the borderlands it's especially true because, you know, we live in a heightened state of rhetoric. We're also exposed to, I think especially on the Mexican side, the violent imagery that you're exposed mm-hmm. to really saturates. You know, I think, you know, the Mexican media is much more apt to put, you know, footage from a drug shootout on the front page of a newspaper that you see on the corner walking to school. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the disconnect, you know, living in somewhere like El Paso and having Ciudad Juarez on the other side. And El Paso, during the years that Ciudad Juarez was the most dangerous city in the world, El Paso was the safest city in the world. And I remember living in El Paso and feeling that disconnect, like driving down the road and looking at Ciudad Juarez. Like,
and you actually didn't cross into Juarez, right?
And I didn't. I had crossed, but never during the time that I was working for the Border Patrol did I cross.
Why is that? I was curious about that. Was it because you may have been criticized by your peers or because it would have looked bad upon a...
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, by everybody that I worked with was from El Paso, and they're like, yeah, we don't, yeah, you're like, it's not a good idea. Just yeah. Don't do it. And so there was fear. I remember feeling like a couple times living in El Paso that I was being followed. But it was really, it was more than that. I think it was like an internal boundary. Yeah. Well, I'll read from this because I think it resonates with just what we see when we look at the news. In an exhaustive study of news coverage in multiple borderland newspapers, Jane Zavisca, a cultural sociologist at the University of Arizona, surveyed 10 years' worth of reporting to determine the most common metaphors used by journalists writing about migrant deaths. Economic metaphors were most predominant, characterizing migrant deaths as a cost, calculation, or gamble. Death is a price that is paid, a toll collected by the desert. Death is the foreseeable outcome of a cost-benefit analysis with measurable, calculable risks and consequences. Death is the ultimate risk in a game of chance, the unlikely result of a roll of the dice. Metaphors like these, Zavisca writes, naturalize death and suggest that migrants bear some responsibility for their own deaths. Violent metaphors were the second largest category, depicting death as the vengeful punishment of an angry desert or the casualty of a war waged along the border. In such discourse, deaths were blamed on unforgiving weather, on lethal immigration policy, on a lack of enforcement against an invading army of migrants. Dehumanizing metaphors constituted Zavisca's third category. Here, migrants were depicted as animals, something hunted, the persecuted prey of smugglers, law enforcement agents, and militant vigilantes. Lured to the border by the prospect of well-paying jobs, migrants engage Border Patrol trackers in a cat-and-mouse game with deadly consequences. A related metaphor, writes Zavisca, depicts enforcement agents as humane shepherds tending to a flock. This illusion reinforces the humanity of Border Patrol while it dehumanizes migrants by portraying the Border Patrol as saviors. An associated livestock metaphor, widespread in Mexico, casts migrants as chickens and smugglers as chicken ranchers, pollos at the mercy of their polleros. Another subcategory of metaphors describes migrants as dangerous waters threatening the nation, a metaphorical home. Enforcement is represented as an effort to staunch the unwieldy flow of migration, the border as a barrier to be plugged and sealed against a rising tide. The corresponding death toll is a surge, and the bodies are part of a flood of migrants that overwhelm Border Patrol agents and medical examiners. It is here that Zavisca cites the work of Otto Santa Anna, a sociolinguist at the University of California, Los Angeles, who argues that, ontologically, such metaphors dehumanize migrants by representing them as, quote, an undifferentiated mass.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, and this has always been my challenge as a journalist, right, is how do you tell stories about the human experience along the border, whether it's from the experience of a migrant or a law enforcement agent, in ways that are nuanced, right? That are full of humanity, or you know, that challenge, that prevailing narrative and all that rhetoric. And you know, I would like for you to talk about as you sat down to write and then actually publish your book and have your words read by Border Patrol, by immigration advocates. What was that process like, and did you have any fears, any concerns about how it was going to be taken?
I think, you know, always writing this book, I was just, you know, in the back of my mind anticipating the backlash of Border Patrol and from the right. You know, I live in Tucson, and as a student and instructor and writer, reporter for the last, you know, 7 years since I left the Border Patrol, I would go to events in Tucson, and you know, literary event or a visiting artist, and if the artist was brown or had a Hispanic sounding name in the slightest, you know, there would quite frequently be, you know, one Minuteman vigilante in the audience who would stand up and you know, shout that person down in the Q&A, and talk about, you know, the invasion that nobody sees. And so I was always waiting for those people, because I was like, you know, all the Border Patrol agents. The Border Patrol is such a closed agency. I think as a reporter, you've probably had this feeling that it's very insular, it's very cagey. Mm-hmm. And so I was always anticipating the reaction of, you know, having sold them out or being, you know, a sympathizer, a quitter, mm-hmm. or whatever. But, you know, since the book has come out, the loudest reaction has been from the left. And you know, when I hear those criticisms, I understand that, you know, at their core, it's a criticism of whose voice gets lifted up, you know, who gets to speak, who gets to tell the story of the border. And I think that it's inherently problematic that, you know, this book with a mainstream publisher, you know, plenty of interest from media outlets, is being written by a former Border Patrol agent, and that, you know, the voice of a Border Patrol agent is sort of being lifted up by the media. And there's been some headlines, you know, everybody must listen to what this Border Patrol agent has to say. And some terrible article referred to, you know, a Border Patrol agent with a heart of gold. And I think, I can imagine, you know, as this has unfolded, you know, social media backlash or you know, different protests at some of my events, it's like, well, of course. Like, of course, if you are undocumented and you're a dreamer, you say, like, why the hell did you need this Border Patrol agent to come along and start talking about how bad things are on the border? Like, we've been telling you that this whole time. Why don't you publish books by us? Like, why don't you lift up our voices? And I think that it's an incredibly important conversation to have right now, because, you know, if we want to know about the about immigration and border issues, you know, the people who are living in constant fear of deportation, the people who are the ones risking their lives by crossing the border, I think they have more to tell us than I do, or than any policymaker does, or any politician. So I think, yeah, I'm on their side.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was an interview you must have given recently where I heard you say that, you know, after your book was done and published, like, there's very little you can do, an author can do, to really control the message or even see what comes of it, right? And I was surprised to see, in fact, that, you know, you started writing in 2014, way before, you know, we heard of Trump.
You know, anything other than a joke.
Anything other than punchline. And you presented your final manuscript right before the election, right? So there's no way you could have seen this coming.
Yeah, you know, the first complete manuscript of the book was my MFA thesis in May of 2016. I was lucky enough to find an agent, and we sold the manuscript at the beginning of October, just before the election.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, the entire time I was working on this book, the entire time, I always imagined that it would be published into a world in which it would be seen as, you know, sort of a relic of an uglier time. Mm-hmm. Always. And, you know, even selling it right before the election, I was doing edits. You know, the big substantive part of the editing process was happening right as, you know, Trump was taking office, and as all of this was unfolding. And it became important to me not to change the manuscript in any way to speak directly toward that, because I think, you know, for anyone who lives along the border or who follows immigration border issues, you know, now the attention of the national media is on the border in a big way. We're having conversations about it, you know, in a way that we haven't maybe for a decade. But I think for those of us who kind of live day to day with our thoughts about these issues, like nothing has changed that mm-hmm. much. Like the actual reality of what's happening on the border, the realities of the people who are crossing, they've changed very little.
And yet what has changed is, as you said earlier when we were chatting, is that apprehensions at the border are down. Fewer people are trying to cross the border without papers, and those that are facing more dangers along the way, right? So, mm-hmm. so that's not something that we're not hearing from them.
Right. I mean, how many times did you hear last year that border crossings were down? They were at their lowest level in 14 mm-hmm. years, and we heard it over and over again. But the deaths along the border actually went up versus the year before.
Right.
So even though less people were crossing, the crossing was more dangerous and more deadly.
Yeah.
And how many times did you read that? I mean, it was like one headline that gets passed around by activists and advocates.
Yeah.
But you know, there's hundreds of people that die every year in the desert. I think there's something, an article that came out in the New York Times last year, estimated that 6,000 people have lost their lives in the desert since the year 2000. And I think that number was, you know, they only had numbers up to 2014 or 2015. So that number is probably well above 7,000. And those are the ones that we know about. And I think, I mean, I really think that it's a crime that we do not talk about that when we talk about immigration reform. And we've been having a conversation about DACA and about immigration reform and about chain migration, you know, changing this long-standing policy of family reunification. Yeah. You know, chain migration is another one of these dehumanizing metaphors.
It's like anchor babies, yeah.
Right. But the issue of this humanitarian crisis, the border only becoming more dangerous for fewer people, that's not talked about. I mean, that to me seems like the moral imperative. That's the first thing that has to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is enforcement through deterrence. It's a policy that, you know, has been in place since the 1990s, by which, you know, the most easy to cross urban areas are heavily enforced, pushing crossings out into the most remote, dangerous parts of the desert where it was once thought, you know, people just won't cross out there. Like, it's too crazy. Who's going to go all the way out there? And of course, we know that now. For decades, we've known that not to be true, but that policy has remained unchanged. And now, what we're talking about is the exact same thing that we're talking about a decade ago when we were having a conversation about immigration reform, which is building more walls mm-hmm. and hiring more Border Patrol agents. And we know what that does. We have all the evidence in front of us.
Yes, I totally agree. And yet, I feel like we're also, you know, adding that extra, we're criminalizing immigrants, all immigrants, in ways that weren't done before. Right now, when we hear Trump or Jeff Sessions speak of any young immigrant being a potential Mara Salvatrucha, MS-13 mm-hmm. gang member, I think we're in a really dangerous moment where it must be hard for you to make a case for reason, right? And looking at history and hearing from all sides. So that leads me to my final question is, I'm curious who you wrote the book for, who you had in mind, what audiences did you have in mind, and what were you hoping to influence?
I absolutely began writing the book for myself. I mean, you know, some of the very first writing that I did was, you know, maybe 6 months to a year after leaving the Border Patrol, and really all it was taking those journal entries that I mentioned earlier mm-hmm. and just like taking them out of this paper journal and like putting them into a Word document so that they were all in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think seeing all of those encounters in one place and like reading them at once, I had never done that before. I mean, I never went back and read through my journal.
Mm.
You know, there was an overwhelming feeling of like all of these individual stories accumulating to the point where you feel crushed by their weight. Mm. And so the book for me began as a way to make sense of my participation in that. But as I thought, as I broadened my scope, and of course, you know, like went into a writing program and thought about other people coming to the book, and there was a few things. Like, first of all, I wanted to create a narrative that left enough room for the reader to inhabit those stories and that work, and to also feel overwhelmed and sort of like crushed by the accumulation of these stories, to sort of inhabit a consciousness in which something like that is made normal, and to sort of be horrified by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, confronted by that realization. Right. Yeah.
And, you know, so I knew that I didn't want the book to be a didactic one. I wanted to whatever degree I could, recreate that feeling for the reader. And I also became, you know, especially in the later stages of writing the book, like I became hyper preoccupied with shifting the narrative from my own first person narrative to the story of this friend, Jose, mm-hmm. who I made after leaving the Border Patrol, who I built up a friendship with, and who was later left the country and was apprehended trying to come back in and was deported. And so in the final third of the narrative, you know, myself as the narrator of the story, you know, slowly, completely fades away. Mm-hmm. And the book ends with Jose's voice. And so I also thought a lot about, you know, if this is the first book that someone reads about the border, or if you can kind of like slyly convince someone in the middle of the political spectrum to pick it up because, oh, I don't know, a Border Patrol agent, like they must have a, mm-hmm. you know, like a, you know, to shift the narrative over to the voice of the migrant. Because, you know, Jose's story absolutely transformed the way I thought about the border, because I had been so fixated on the actual border itself, the terrain where the border is drawn across the landscape.
Yeah.
That when I saw Jose's story unfold, especially for his family, I became conscious of all the ways that the border is brought into people's lives. It is thrust upon someone. You know, for Jose's three children who were born in the United States who never crossed a border, you know, the border was thrust into their lives, and you know, they were completely riven by it. It took their father from them. And
how did they feel about you writing about them?
You know, something really interesting happened that in answering that question, I started to reflect on when Jose, you know, when I first asked him about writing his story, and sort of interviewing him at length, and you know, using these documents and these letters, you know, he knew that I was writing. I was a MFA student, like when we were becoming friends. But something changed in the way that he would speak to me about his decisions and about his situation, because, you know, I remember him saying, you know, that he wanted people to know his moral calculus. You know, he wanted people to, it was almost like, and I think this happens probably a lot of people who are reporters have similar experience, when someone has the idea that you're going to bring their story to others, they start to tell it differently. And one of the things that happened was, you know, instead of just commiserating with a friend about his situation, he began to, you know, justify his actions in a very particular way, because he wanted people to understand why he was doing what he was doing. And I remember him explaining to me, you know, I respect the laws of the United States. The rule of law in the United States is what makes me want to live there and not in Mexico. And I understand that a nation needs to enforce its borders, and I understand, you know, why I can't be allowed to enter. I get it. But my family values dictate that, you know, my sons are not dogs to be abandoned in the street. I won't, you know, as somebody who has to feel that I am a good father, I can't bring my children back to Mexico, and I can't just sit by while they grow up without me. So, you know, he saw his family values as superseding that law. And I think he actually saw his actions as an act of civil disobedience almost. And, you know, so for me, it's impossible to think of Jose or anyone in his situation as a criminal.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Francisco. It's been a
My pleasure.
Been lovely.
Thank you.
So we're ready for questions, and I think the mics are going around.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I just want to say that when you read the depiction of the dream, of the image of the dead body, you brought me the emotion, the pain and suffering of having gone to the Imperial Valley with the water stations project to deliver water along the border. And when I was there, I was not expecting to find my cousin dead. And I guess it was an act of God. I found my blonde, güero primo, 23-year-old, dead, put in a black sealed plastic bag in the poor people's cemetery. So I think you have done a great job because you raised awareness about the pain and suffering of people that go through that. But I also wanted to ask you, how do you feel about the fact that the Border Patrol agents from Arizona are actually kicking, throwing the water to impede the survival of other immigrants who cross the border in search of a better life? Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much for sharing that story. I can't believe that. You know, I think to answer your question, the humanitarian groups that leave water in the desert, I think what they're doing is trying to fill this deadly void that has been left by this policy of enforcement through deterrence that I described earlier. And so our policy pushes people into the most dangerous parts of the desert, the places literally where someone is most likely to die. Yeah. And so these humanitarian groups are, you know, doing their best to patch that hole. And so I think for Border Patrol agents to destroy that aid and to criminalize the act of giving humanitarian aid, mm-hmm. some humanitarian aid workers were arrested in Arizona and are being charged in federal court. I think it's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. I think it's unforgivable, and I think that the Border Patrol has to be held accountable for that. And I think we have to hold the Border Patrol accountable for that. I think it's been known for a long time. It was, you know, it's never been official policy, but it was something that was passed down to us. You know, I never physically saw water bottles being slashed, but I heard agents talk about it. And there's a culture of callousness that mm-hmm. permits something like that. And I think that it's been known for so long, but there hasn't been enough outrage to change the culture because the Border Patrol hides behind the fact that, oh, our policy is not to do that. Mm. You know, but as we know, the culture of an institution prevails. So I think we all have to be outraged and to not forget. I mean, honestly, what I hope, I think, you know, there should be a cache of these videos somewhere. I hope someone has a cache of these videos and releases one every month so that it just never leaves the headlines. Because when I think about those water bottles being destroyed, I think about the dead body that I saw in the desert. And I think about explaining to that man's nephew, you know, why he had to leave that body and couldn't bring that body back to Mexico with him. And I think that, you know, if that man had had an extra bottle of water, an extra gallon of water, he might not have lost his life. So it's incredibly, you know, when we hear these numbers, right, like hundreds of people died last year, deaths increased, 6,000 people have died since the year 2000, that's so impersonal. It's a statistic, but, you know, we've just heard a story of that. And I mean, you can never let that go. You can never let the individual story go. Each one of those numbers has to be seen as representing an individual life.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think perhaps it's easier for a Border Patrol agent whose job is equally to interdict drugs and drug runners as you know, border crossers, to make the assumption, right, that we're talking, all these people are breaking the law, these are criminals, that's the danger, right, and buying into that simplistic and, you know, wrongful rhetoric. And I think that's what we're getting a lot of these days, right? Yes.
Recently, I had the opportunity to hear Nick Stein speak. Mm. He had been the producer of Border Wars and was embedded with the Border Patrol for several years. The show was on National Geographic Channel. He started to suffer a nervous breakdown, and basically his therapist told him he needed to learn how to meditate, and it really saved his life and his marriage and everything else. He realized that he was not alone in having these really conflicted feelings, and a lot of the agents he saw and knew and became friends with were really having these horrible, you know, mental consternations and conflicts like you had basically spoken about. He's now teaching Border Patrol agents meditation so that they can better handle their jobs. And the fact that, you know, as you said, unfortunately, some of these people, it's the only job that they can get. And it's very difficult. And I just wondered if you, in your time with the Border Patrol, if you had, you know, experiences with your fellow agents where you really saw, you know, some emotional issues like that, where the agents just really weren't equipped to handle those situations that they were really maybe forced into, unfortunately.
You know, I think in the Border Patrol, much like a lot of military or law enforcement work, there's not a culture of talking about the ways that your work can impact your sense of morals and ethics. I think that you know, it's interesting. Since I got like some early copies of the book, I sent them basically to all of my colleagues or former coworkers who are represented in the text in some way, and a couple of friends who were my coworkers in the Border Patrol, and one of my friends called me, and he said, you know, I wanted to say I'm really proud of you for writing this book, but really I want to say I'm sorry for not asking how you're doing. For never checking in on you, and you know, like I like lived in his backyard. You know, I like rented out a house, and so. And of course, I said, you know, there's nothing to apologize for, because that was what we were equipped with. We weren't equipped with a way to talk about these things. In my experience writing the book, as I began to share some of the writing in like workshops or with, you know, writing professors, you know, people started to ask me like, oh, do you think you have PTSD? And I was like, no, that sounds crazy. But I began to, I went to a therapist, I went to a Jungian psychoanalyst to like process these dreams because I continued having them even years after leaving the Border Patrol. And I did, you know, I started to do some research about post-traumatic stress, and I found out about this thing called moral injury. And moral injury is, there's a book called What Have We Done by David Wood that is kind of like a big study of moral injury among veterans of the Iraq and Afghan war. And moral injury is sort of this, it's kind of like PTSD light. It's like next to PTSD. And so PTSD is characterized by a bodily response to something that triggers a past trauma. So, you know, flashing lights or a crowd in Walmart, you know, triggering a memory of being in a war zone and, you know, having a panic attack or shutting down. Whereas moral injury is characterized by kind of nothing more than dreams and doubts and unease, but like a sort of sickening, unceasing sense of unease, and that comes from just having violated what you know to be your own moral code, or your own sense of ethics or humanity. And so I became interested in moral injury as you know, perhaps something that I experienced, that many Border Patrol agents and people in institutions, violent institutions, would experience. But also I began to think about moral injury on a societal level. I mean, I really think that, especially in the context of Mexico that has, you know, gone through decades now of just being ravaged by violence, you know, that even if it doesn't touch you directly, is always close at hand.
And you can find yourself implicated in multiple ways. Yeah.
And so I began to think of you know, the way that an entire nation can feel that moral code has been violated and how that can be passed on.
Wow. Yeah.
Actually, I have two questions. The first is speaking to the point about the criticism from the left. And I think we tend to really only listen to the people who already philosophically align with our beliefs. So I'm kind of wondering if you know a little bit about your book sales. Are they being bought by people on the right? Like, do you think that maybe the identity of having been a Border Patrol agent makes your story maybe more accessible to people who don't automatically philosophically align with kind of what you talk about? So that's my first question, kind of in conflict with what that criticism is. And the second is, as I was reading your book, the thing that really stuck with me was this idea of like that young idealism of wanting to know all the answers. And I guess you kind of spoke to this in the beginning. You kind of left with more questions than answers. So are we asking the wrong questions? And did you come with any answers at all, like policy-wise, you know, economic policy or other?
To your first question, it would be cool if when you bought a book you had to check a box that said, you know, like where you stand on the issue or, you know, on the political spectrum. So, I mean, I have no real way of knowing. What I do know is that, you know, from friends or colleagues that were in the Border Patrol, I'm not a popular figure within the Border Patrol chat rooms. And, you know, I have like, Twitter trolls on the right, and on the left. The people from the right haven't showed up to protest my readings, so maybe they're just more lazy. but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I think that sort of what you said, you know, here's the narrative of a Border Patrol agent, and that's kind of been behind the initial, like, publicity push of the book. You know, I think that's a, you know, one thing is that I think for liberal media, the Border Patrol being such a closed agency and seeing so sealed off, I think that there's this urge to be like, oh, here we have, a representative, a humane, nice-seeming representative of the Border Patrol. So there's almost this move to humanize me as a Border Patrol agent and thus the agency of the Border Patrol over the actual message of the book, which is about, you know, the dehumanization of migrants and the ways that we diminish the migrant through our institutions, our rhetoric, our media. And then to your second question, it was about policy. I think, you know, honestly, at its most simplistic level, I think what I left, you know, like my biggest suggestion, if the book could do one thing to move the needle of our conversation, I would hope that it leads us to have a conversation with more complexity. And, you know, I think that we talk about the border in black and white terms. And, you know, that's where that impulse, the idea that, you know, we can build a wall, like the reason that has so much purchase is because the border is this huge, complex thing that we have not had the political will to address. Mm-hmm. And the idea of building a wall makes sense to people who live far away from the border. This is the end of the earth to them. It's the frontier of our nation. They have, you know, no real concept of this as a cultural landscape, mm-hmm. Or as a physical space. And so, yeah, sure, build a wall. That sounds great. Cool.
A beautiful concrete, like, wall.
Done. Yeah. I think, you know, we have to resist in our policy discussions the impulse to talk about to simplify these issues. I think if there's ever going to be meaningful policy reform, you know, we're going to be like grasping in the dark for a way forward, and there is no perfect way forward. I think the one policy thing that we know that is broken, that has to change, is, you know, this enforcement through deterrence. You know, it's precipitated a humanitarian crisis. I think that can change. That can be the first thing that can change.
Okay. It's a little bit morbid. In the second book of Bolaño's trilogy, 2999, the border across El Paso, the landscape outside Juarez, is described as a massive graveyard of a mark, a burial places. Can you speak about that landscape in the border, a landscape, using your own words, that journals against forgetting?
When I was, you know, reading, I'm glad you mentioned Bolaño. 2666 was this book that I read before I joined the Border Patrol, and I think it really, like, fueled my obsession with the border. And, you know, when I was writing the book and I was, you know, interrogating some of these themes, I was reading a lot about bodies. And there's this book by Sara Uribe. It's a book of poetry called Antígona González. And it's translated by John Plucker. And the book is written in response to sort of this plague of disappearance in Mexico, and it's very concerned with how can you grieve without having a body, and we heard about that, and so I think to me, quite honestly, the issue that I carry with me the most is this issue of how do we mourn the deaths of the people who've died crossing the border if we don't know their names, and also, you know, if we don't read about their deaths. I mean, I live in Tucson, and you never read the names of the people who die along the border in your local paper the way that you read about the old lady down the street who died. and I think that would change. I mean, if you picked up the paper every week and you read, you know, even if it was just unidentified, or you read the name of all the people who died in your county that week, I think it would make a huge impact. I also just think, you know, driving anywhere along the border, like within a 50-mile range of the border, I just think about all, you know, I've heard some estimates being, you know, for every one body that we find, you know, there's as many as four or five. It's hard to conceive of how massive, and that's why I'm glad we watched that video. I mean, every single frame of that film represents an immense landscape. And the idea as you're driving across this desert that there are bodies out there, and that there are just places of departure that we are ignorant to, that we're just cruising along the freeway. I mean, it's overwhelming, but we have to be overwhelmed and moved by that in order for anything to change, I think. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming, and thanks,
Francisco. Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.